This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Sally Denton. She's a historian, investigative journalist, and author. Her new book is The Profiteers, Bechtel and the Men Who Built the World. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's great to be here again.
It's always great to have you on the show, and this is a fantastic book about the company Bechtel, which is, what, about 100 years old or so?
Yeah, it's basically 100 years old, depending on when you decide, you know, the birth of Bechtel, I guess. I mean, it started really at the turn of the 20th century.
Right. In Nevada, which is where you're from, have you been aware of them all your life?
Oh, yeah. I grew up in Boulder City, which was the company town built by Bechtel for the construction of Hoover Dam. So it's always been kind of, and my parents, I grew up in the home, the first private home in Boulder City that was built by one of the chief engineers of the dam. So it's overlooking Lake Mead. The builder had kind of topped off a mountain and put the home there. Where he thought the dam would back up the Colorado River, and so that it would have the best view of Lake Mead, of the entire area, and it still does. my family still is in the home. And
wow.
So as from a little kid, I was there since I was 4 years old. As a little kid, I always knew, I mean, Bechtel was all over Boulder City, just the logo, not their presence anymore. The dam was completed in 1933, so... But it was a company town, and everybody worked on the dam. My family, my father, my parents were in politics in Las Vegas, 23 miles away. But most of Boulder City was created by six companies who built the dam.
You, in your book, call the Hoover Dam a symbol of everything that was right and wrong with America. What do you mean?
Well, it was an amazing engineering feat, and it was considered one of the great wonders of the world at the time. And, I mean, what was fantastic about it was the ability to create something like that, to tame the wildest river in the United States, certainly, which is why six companies did it, because there were... There was not one Western company that was capable, a construction company capable of doing it on their own. So they brought together six, it was actually eight companies, but they called themselves six companies after the Chinese
mafia.
Yeah, the Chinese mafia from San Francisco. But so it was the first mega project in the American West. And it changed the landscape of the American West forever. I mean, it's what made Phoenix and Las Vegas and Southern California possible for the kind of astronomical growth, and really signified the shift from the East to the American Southwest. But that's the best part. Well, and arguably, I mean, obviously, some environmentalists would not think that that was the greatest thing to happen to, you know, harness the water and make electricity in order for this huge population migration. When I say the worst part, I mean the kind of labor practices that happened there. It was really, it was at the height of the Depression, and so people from all over America were coming to work on the dam in grueling conditions of, you know, 120 to 140 degrees. They were all white men. There were no African Americans or Chinese allowed. There were no Jews, and so it was really kind of a microcosm of really brutal working conditions and with very little labor protection.
And people would have to work in very tightly constricted tunnels with trucks driving through them. They'd die of carbon monoxide poisoning, and then the company would call it pneumonia, so they didn't have to pay any claims.
Yeah, and there were, I mean, that was horrendous. And it actually took them, it was, you know, the dam began in 31. They worked under breakneck speed to maximize profits, and that's where I think is, one of the negative aspects of it. It was really, they worked under very harsh conditions, and and, you know, the summer heat, but they didn't even have water or helmets, and it took a team, I think, of Harvard medical professionals to come out and look at the site to find out why so many workers were dying. And they were the first to determine that dehydration was actually a factor.
A cause of death.
Yeah, a cause of death. And then and there were always the stories of, you know, it was right on the border in the Black Canyon between, the dam crosses the border between Nevada and Arizona. And so Nevada actually had stricter labor rules than Arizona. And so there were all these stories of, you know, people dying on the Nevada side and being taken over to the Arizona side because there was no oversight in that state.
Oh, my goodness. So how did Bechtel develop from there? Hoover Dam, huge project, and from an engineering standpoint, for many years, very successful.
Mm-hmm.
What happened next?
Well, Hoover Dam really put them on the map. It was such a massive project. And the story goes that Warren Bechtel, it was this five-generation dynasty really begins with Warren Bechtel, who had been a road grader. He didn't live to see the completion of the dam. He was, according to corporate lore, he was invited to the Soviet Union to meet with Stalin and consult with the Soviets about building dams over there. He died quite mysteriously while he was there. And it's a mystery also because there were no diplomatic relations between the United States and the Soviet Union. There was no embassy, no diplomatic relations. And so then his son, Stephen Bechtel, ended up taking over the company. There were three sons, and there was a bit of a rivalry between them, but Stephen, the middle son, ended up in charge of the company. And he really took it into, started diversifying away from just construction. The first thing they did was get into shipbuilding leading up to World War II and became very successful at that. And that was done with a partner named John McCone. And this, and I think McCone really signifies the step into the next phase that takes them into more of an international company instead of just a construction and engineering firm in the American West. They had mostly done roads and railroads and some gas and oil pipelines in the United States. So the next phase really was John McCone coming in with Stephen Bechtel. They had known each other originally in college at UC Berkeley, and then McCone sold steel to the Six Companies Consortium for the dam. So they branched into first shipbuilding and then ultimately into nuclear reactors after that. They got the first contract to build the first nuclear reactor in the United States. And then McCone, it became Bechtel McCone was the name of the company for a while. McCone branched out and decided he wanted to go into government rather than private industry. And he had become a multi-millionaire at this point. And he ended up going from, he was called the American Onassis because of their shipbuilding empire. McCone ended up going in to advise the administrations, Truman and then Eisenhower, on defense issues, and he ended up becoming the head of the Atomic Energy Commission.
And eventually the head of the CIA?
And then ultimately the head of the CIA.
And so this represents what is called, even today, the revolving door between government and industry.
Right.
And in some ways it's kind of ironic that Eisenhower, who gave that famous oft-quoted speech about being careful of the danger of the military-industrial complex, was really close to the Bechtel people.
Mm-hmm. I know. He warned about it, and it was a great irony that I argue that you know, Bechtel personified the military-industrial complex, as it turned out. I mean, Eisenhower warned about the cozy relationship between the military and private industry, and especially in the creation and development of weapons, and they were very close. I mean, the Bechtels were very, Stephen Bechtel Sr. was very close with Eisenhower, as was John McCone. That they branched out into that, I think, was kind of a, well, back to the revolving door. I argue that Bechtel actually created it. I mean, now it's just, it's pro forma. Every company does it. Every industry, every every company.
And when we say revolving door, I mean, what we're talking about is people having jobs for a company and then going to work for government, people working for a government going to have jobs for the company, and the deep influence that those people have on each other.
Well, I mean, I think it starts with people in government getting, you know, expertise, and that started even as far back as Frank Crowe, who built the Hoover Dam. He had worked for the Department of Interior, who knew exactly what the specs should be for the dam, so they were able to come in the lowest bidder on that contract by a significant amount. But it really, I think the revolving door began with people in government getting government, you know, expertise that then take that into the private industry. And it, I mean, Bechtel first started mining federal government for experts in both defense, energy, intelligence, and then it started, I mean, that's the traditional revolving door for someone to go from government to private industry. And there's usually, I mean, later legislation resulted in a cooling off period so that you couldn't just go, you know, directly from government, and so that companies couldn't just mine government for all the experts. But it's a very attractive thing when you're thinking about, you know, getting a $100,000 salary in government and a $350,000 salary for a private company. Bechtel was not only, I think, at the forefront of kind of designing this revolving door that really started, I think, with John McCone going into government, from industry into government, and then helping direct contracts, nuclear reactor contracts, to Bechtel. But then the later iteration of that with this company is that they would go back and forth. I mean, as we saw in the Reagan administration with George Shultz and Cap Weinberger, they came from the Nixon administration to Bechtel, and then from Bechtel back to the Reagan administration, and then in George Shultz's case, from Reagan back to Bechtel, and so that there's this kind of seamless movement that you can't make a determination between, you know, are you operating on behalf of the best interests of the American government or on the best interests of the corporation you work for?
And I think in their minds, they were kind of one and the same. I was wondering if you could talk about the perspective of Stephen Bechtel and John McCone on American security and economics.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had what I think you call a kind of realistic, pragmatic view of those things, which may not match up with those of a lot of citizens.
Well, I think you have to keep in context the time period we're talking about, and it actually starts before McCone even, or contiguous with McCone. There was a Bechtel family member named John Simpson who had worked for the Schroeder firm in New York and was very involved in covert intelligence post-World War II with the Marshall Plan, was close to the Dulles brothers and worked with the Dulles brothers, Secretary of State and the OSS. And the genesis of that relationship between Bechtel and intelligence, I think, really was the post-World War II, the beginning of the Cold War, where there was a real ideology, anti-communist ideology. And so they thought that, I think, that the company was in lockstep with the government. This was a very anti-communist moment. And then along comes, you know, Nixon and the domino theory and the concept that they were together and that whatever the national intelligence was doing was in the best interest of the United States. And it was a right-wing point of view at that time and driven largely by this elite. It was the beginning of the creation of from OSS into the CIA. So I think there was an alignment. They thought they were you know, it was a symbiotic relationship between government and Bechtel.
There's a number of ironies here. I mean, besides the fact that the military industrial complex was something that was to be warned against, and yet Eisenhower was participating in it so heavily, and all really one president after another with the Bechtel Corporation, but also a really kind of American irony that you could call maybe our greatest hypocrisy, namely that those who are calling themselves, like Bechtel, free market capitalists, but whose only employer is the government and therefore the taxpayers. They're continually manipulating the government and even foreign policy for their own economic ends. They're getting no-bid contracts. They're getting certain kinds of protectionism. They're lobbying. They're giving campaign contributions. They're doing something called guaranteed profit.
Mm-hmm.
Every single one of those is antithetical to the basic concept of free market capitalism.
Right. And that's the greatest irony of all. And I have some quotes in there from the Bechtel men being asked to give interviews. I think Stephen Bechtel Sr. at one point, Newsweek wanted to interview him, and Stephen Bechtel Jr., and he said he declined the interview and said there's no reason for people to hear of us. We're not selling to the public.
Right.
And, you know, that's like the greatest irony of all. Well, I mean, the public has been paying for everything that Bechtel's been constructing since Warren Bechtel, the founder, got his first contracts with, you know, for the road grading. He got the first private contract to build roads in California at the beginning of the 20th century.
Right. We're talking to Sally Denton about her book, The Profiteers, Bechtel and the Men Who Built the World. It's interesting that this company is, as you write about, a five-generation dynasty when succession from father to son and so on doesn't usually work.
It rarely works. I was just talking about that this morning, that's one of the things that fascinated me about this company is it's really unique in that it's five generations of Bechtel men, and successions like that don't usually happen. There's usually it's the, you know, by the second generation, it's hard to keep the second generation intact, and the third is almost, you know, unheard of. So I really found it interesting, and you know the big difference here. I mean, Bechtel is not aberrant. Bechtel is not the uniqueness is that it's. It's like the Koch brothers. It's privately held.
Yeah.
And so that obviously creates certain challenges for writing about them because of the lack of transparency. They don't have to file reports with the Securities and Exchange Commission. They don't have to report to stockholders. You know, so that it's all very, you kind of have to take whatever they claim at face value.
And they have their own company lore and narrative.
Oh, yeah. They have a very elaborate company narrative that if you go to the Bechtel website, they have all of their projects listed, and they're very proud of all of them. And so some of the projects that I list in my book, they might not be pleasantly anticipated in the countries where they are, but if you look at the company website, they're blaring their horn about it. So it is this kind of dichotomy. They're very proud. On the one hand, they're secretive, but they're also very proud and glorifying of their projects.
Are their projects, by and large, of good quality?
I'm sure there must be. I mean, they claim to have done 25,000 projects on every continent in the world, and I mean, they do have a pretty negative reputation for going over budget, over time, safety violations. I mean, that's kind of something that plagues them in, you know, the big dig in Boston and Hanford vitrification in Washington and the safety issues at Los Alamos with the drum and then with, I think, a burning of a victim, burning an employee. And then there were problems with a nuclear facility in Tarapur, India. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that when you look at the kinds of projects that are massive, I mean, they're really technological wonders, all of these. So I'm sure many of them must be very successful. And I know that the founder, Warren, was a real stickler for cleanliness and having the job site. And they're still known for that today. Having the job site be very clean and neat. And
although not safe.
Although not always safe.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure, it's hard to look at 25,000 projects and determine how many were safe and how many were not.
Yeah.
But they are riddled with allegations of safety violations.
And another thing that happened was that eventually their sexism and racism and anti-Semitism started to catch up with them. And they got quite a lot of bad publicity and some lawsuits in the 1970s.
Yeah, the 70s. And, well, they sided with the Arab boycott. And so that kind of identified them as anti-Semitic.
The Arab boycott being?
Being not agreeing for the Arab states, agreeing not to do any business with Israel or with any Israeli companies or Jewish companies. And so that kind of stuck with them. I mean, I think there, and there was a one of the Bechtel daughters married a Jewish man, and there was some resistance to that initially. As far as the practices now, I'm not sure, but I would doubt that they, I mean, if they've, they have been a major player throughout the Middle East for the last, you know, 60, 70 years, or since the 40s, and I don't think they've ever built a project in Israel. If they have, it's been in recent years.
And there is a kind of uncomfortable connection between Bechtel's anti-Semitism, the Arab boycott, American foreign policy at the time, and how those things wove together.
Well, especially in the Middle East, I mean, they were very at the forefront of building in Saudi Arabia, building the first big pipelines, and were inextricably enmeshed with the oil companies and the first oil production in the Middle East in Saudi Arabia, and then into, I mean, throughout, they just went up, you know, every country basically. Where I think it became kind of conflicting is in areas like Iran, when they started being clearly aligned with the new American-backed militarist replacement, dictator replacements throughout the Middle East. And
the Shah of Iran,
the Shah of Iran, Mossadegh,
etc.
And yeah, etc. I mean, so they would end up in, they were always on the side of the newly American installed dictator.
And this is where it gets so terrifying and morally difficult, is when you have a company whose interest is entirely its own profit, influencing foreign policy and basically participating in one way or another in having democratically elected people overthrown in favor of dictators who would build the things they wanted to build.
Right. I mean, because most of the democratically elected leaders throughout the world that were being overthrown, the first thing they did was start nationalizing their resources, which was a great threat to the oil companies and the tap line and pipeline constructors. So that was, but this was also, again, in the context of the historic era, this was a time when it was generally thought to be in America's best interest to take control of the world's resources. And that they were, as I said, in lockstep together. That changes as you go forward into, you know, Cuba and the Bay of Pigs and into Vietnam, and where there's some resistance in the United States towards that kind of imperialist impulse.
Well, and you can start to understand why these countries started nationalizing their own industries when the United States, in partnership with companies like Bechtel, was basically exploiting these resources for their own profit. The losers were the citizens of those countries.
Right, and it's still going on today.
Yeah.
And today more in water than in oil. And it's a prototype. I mean, there's a lot of exploitation of water throughout the world with private companies, you know, going into communities and countries and taking charge of the water, and all of a sudden the rates are exorbitant for the people. Same with natural gas, with mining, with, you know, all of the world's resources.
Bechtel tried to do that in Bolivia,
mm-hmm.
and the people of Bolivia basically kicked him out.
Right, there was an uprising against them. I mean, they took over the water, and then the water rates, and this was in a place where, you know, the average daily income was so remarkably tiny, it was appalling, and all of a sudden, you know, they jacked up the prices of the water, and there was a revolt.
Talk about the relationship between Bechtel and the overthrow of President Salvador Allende of Chile.
Well, that one was really, it was not Bechtel's at that point. It was John McCone, who had left the CIA and was director with ITT, which had the telecommunications contracts in Chile. And Allende was the democratically installed leader, who, and there were plots, I think it was Operation Ajax, to get rid of him by the CIA. And McCone personally offered the CIA $1 million in back-channel money to fund the covert operation.
McCone was a long-time director at Bechtel, then he was head of the CIA, then, as you said, he was involved in Chile. And one of the many ways that Bechtel was involved in the CIA was the company provided cover for CIA agents.
Mm-hmm. That started working early on, back even with the OSS, before the CIA was created, but basically where there was a relationship, an early relationship between Bechtel and National Intelligence, where they would provide information. You know, Bechtel was operating throughout the world, and they would provide information to the CIA about events in that, you know, that area of the world, and the CIA would provide intelligence to them about, it was a dual pathway. They were both serving each other's interests. Sometimes Bechtel provided cover for CIA agents. That happened routinely, and not just Bechtel. I mean, I think a lot of the American companies did that. And in exchange for that, Bechtel was on the ground floor of, you know, knowing what the intelligence situation was in any country, so they were prepared to go in and do the construction and building of whatever the next iteration of leadership was going to be. So they ended up building a lot of palaces for dictators throughout the Middle East. I mean, there's a line in one of them, you know, first come the bulldozers and then come the ambassadors.
It's so striking the way your book opens. It's kind of you set the scene with a description of Saddam Hussein's ruined palace, mm-hmm. in 2003, which is then taken over and transformed into the U.S. Embassy on this huge campus, much to the chagrin of Iraqi citizens. But it's such a strange and surrealistic caricature of American capitalism.
Well, I think, as you have pointed out really brilliantly, I think that throughout this book is just a string of ironies that are really, you know, they're hard to fathom. And that is one of them. I mean, that Bechtel built the original infrastructure for, you know, the original Iraqi leader back in the 50s, and then that Saddam Hussein, and, you know, they did business with Saddam Hussein. They then, after the, quote, weapons of mass destruction were found, you know, they really lobbied George W. Bush to go to war against him. And so then they ended up with the first major construction project to rebuild the palace, which will rebuild all of Iraq. And then the palace ends up becoming the American embassy. Then the American companies, you know, went in to build that. We still don't even really know what the final account of that is. But, yeah, the ironies through Libya, Iraq, Iran. Here we've got this battle going with Iran over nuclear capabilities. And there was a time when Bechtel was in partnership with the Shah of Iran trying to build nuclear reactors in Alabama for the use of the Shah for Iran. And then I was thinking back to an earlier irony you pointed out, you know, John McCone. I mean, one of the other great ironies with him is that JFK brought him into the CIA to replace Alan Dulles after the disaster of the Bay of Pigs. And he brought in somebody because he didn't trust the CIA anymore, and he was looking for someone who would come in and reform it. I mean, Kennedy famously said, you know, he wanted to blow the CIA to 1,000 smithereens or something. Yeah. So he brings in McCone, a fellow Catholic, who he thought, you know, would have the same interest. And instead, McCone tightened it, made it more secretive, participated and supported more covert operations throughout the world than Kennedy would ever have wanted. And so there's that. And then there's the whole Middle Eastern irony is just, it's so stark, and that here they're promoters of the Iraq war, which arguably has resulted in ISIS and the whole conflagration now.
The 2003 Iraq war.
Right.
Yeah. We're talking to historian and investigative journalist Sally Denton about her new book, The Profiteers,
Bechtel and the Men Who Built the World.
One thing that's really striking about Bechtel is the culture, the corporate culture, the culture of the leaders there. It is such a men's club. It's golf. It's the Bohemian Grove. It's it's a world in which women are never, at least when the lawsuits started coming down in the 1970s, were never promoted. Talk about that and the influence of that culture on the ideology of Bechtel.
Well, it really is a classic all-male patriarchal organization and has been from the beginning. And I think that, that culture very much dovetailed with the chauvinistic culture of American foreign policy throughout the Cold War and continuing today. But I think that it will be really interesting actually to see if the company takes a new, more modern direction under the helm of Brendan Bechtel, the new head, who's, I think, in his early 30s and just ascended to head the company. But yes, it's been very much a good old boys club. They, you know, were among the earliest attendees of the Bohemian Grove in California.
Which is this super weird men's club where grown men act like college boys and run around naked. And
I mean, it's probably not that different from, you know, this ranch in Texas where Antonin Scalia just went and was, you know, shooting quail or big game or whatever they do down there. Bohemian Grove started out as a kind of an intellectual and literary center in the early 1900s in Northern California, late 1800s. But it's evolved into this kind of camp for men, and mostly Republican men. I mean, there have been a couple of Democrats who have gone, maybe Clinton, but it's really, it's always a focal point for Republican national leaders to go, and deals are made. Supposedly, you can't make any deals while you're there, but relationships are formed. That's where Nixon first decided whether or not he was going to run for president. It's where Reagan decided when he would run for president. It's where, you know, every president, every Republican president, I think back to Hoover, has attended.
Now, Bechtel is a very secretive company, as you say, and they're a privately held company, so they don't fall under the restrictions of the SEC and companies that are publicly traded. How did you do your research? How did you find out everything that you wrote in this book?
Well, it was, you know, it was daunting at first because first of all, when I signed my contract with Simon & Schuster to write this book about Bechtel, this company that was, as I said, in my childhood backyard, what I was really expecting was, you know, more about the old Hoover Dam and how did this company go from this mega project in the 1930s during the Depression to building Ivanpah Solar. It was like they came full circle, you know, 60 miles away, they were building the biggest solar plant in America. And so I was really, that really struck my interest. And I, you know, watched the construction of Ivanpah and was thinking, well, I wonder what Bechtel's been doing for the last 75 years between the dam and this. And even when I sold my contract to Simon & Schuster, it was really with the focus. I'm a fourth-generation Nevadan. I'm very much, you know, Western-centric. I live in Santa Fe for 25 years. And I was really expecting it to be about water, about the West, about regional development, about the creation of a political center during the Reagan Revolution, a political center in the American West, and what that meant for politics in the country. And so I was kind of expecting a pretty narrow project. It wasn't until I started researching and realizing that, you know, first of all, I think that was the when I started getting into the nuclear stuff, when I realized that they were managing the entire, you know, the nation's entire nuclear weapons complex. I mean, I knew they had been building McCarran. I knew McCarran Airport in Las Vegas. I knew they had been involved in the Nevada test site. But it wasn't until the privatization of the nuclear labs and they became the managers of Los Alamos that I started looking into that department and actually started realizing, I don't think most people know, that the Department of Energy, that the energy industrial complex in some ways is far more dangerous than the military industrial complex. And then when they go hand in hand together. That's even, you know, more complicated. But the DOE is one of the largest. I mean, it contracts out between 94 and 97% of its jobs to private contractors, and Bechtel is one of the major, if not the major, subcontractor with DOE.
And it's not just nuclear energy, but nuclear weapons.
Nuclear weapons, yeah. And so the nuclear weapons are at the labs, and it's not just Los Alamos. It's, you know, 17 different laboratories. When I started looking at that, I realized, and then their role in building nuclear weapons and or nuclear reactors throughout the world, then I realized, wow, they've been completely off the radar for 75 years. That's when I realized that this was a much bigger book than what I had first anticipated, and it ended up taking me 4 years instead of 2 years. But really, the research, I was able to do research at the Library of Congress and have access to all of their databases throughout the world, and that really opened up the Middle East for me as a journalism approach.
Tell us more about Bechtel and Los Alamos National Laboratory. I remember when they took over the management of LANL some years ago. That was the first time I actually heard the term guaranteed profit, which I put in my collection of oxymorons. But what has that process been like, the management of LANL under Bechtel?
Well, it's very surprising to me, which I found in the research here, that most Americans have no idea that the nuclear weapons labs have been privatized. And this was done under George W. Bush in 2007, and Bechtel got the contract. And Bechtel, throughout previous decades, had kind of refined the guaranteed profit, the cost-plus mechanism, which is basically that you build something for a set cost, you're guaranteed a 30% profit by the government.
And 30%?
10 to 30, it's usually, yeah, 30%.
So that basically means, I mean, companies becoming huge multimillionaires, multibillionaires now,
mm-hmm.
on the dime of the taxpayer.
Absolutely, yeah. And but as far as LANL, when they took over, there were some a lot of layoffs at the time of LANL, but where I really got a glimpse into the mechanism that what was going on at the labs was through LINS, which was the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in Berkeley, which happened at the same time. One of the challenges I had, because of the private nature of the company, I always thought that I would find a lot of litigation that you can mine. Even if a company is privately held, usually there are thousands and thousands of lawsuits when you're talking about stakes so high. And I found it really fascinating that what was missing, like, where were their rivals? How come Fluor is not suing them for monopolizing the market? Or how come, you know, why are all their competitors so silent? And I just thought it was remarkable that a company of this size for this long had so little litigation on files throughout jurisdictions throughout America. And I found out along the way that it was that the company requires, with any of their negotiations with other firms or on projects, it requires employees to sign agreements that any disputes would be settled through arbitration, which is another, you know, another shield one has to pierce as a journalist, because that keeps it all private.
So that's another privatization.
Right.
We have the privatization of national laboratories, of foreign policy, now of the judicial system,
right,
where it applies to Bechtel.
And of construction in war-torn countries, and as I write in my book, of disaster, you know, the privatization of the Hurricane Katrina disasters,
right,
and
right,
it just keeps going. But one of the great opportunities for me was in looking at Livermore and Los Alamos. There was not litigation at Los Alamos that was very revealing. There's a whistleblower suit and a couple of other things. But when I really was able to penetrate it was when I found a lawsuit in Oakland against Livermore on behalf of 140 laid-off employees.
Livermore, at the time, managed by Bechtel.
It had been managed by, well, it still is managed by Bechtel, but it had been managed by, both of the labs had been managed by the University of California since the Manhattan Project. But so when Bechtel took over, they came into Berkeley or Livermore and laid off, there was a massive layoff of employees, and a lawyer named Gary Gwilliam took on the case of 140 of those as plaintiffs in a wrongful termination suit against Bechtel, and was successful, recently successful. It went on for many years, but he recently got a judgment, or there was a settlement. But that allowed me, because those employees had been employees of the University of California, they were not restricted by a privatized judicial approach through arbitration.
And that was how you could find out more information.
Then, yeah, there were thousands of pages of depositions and expert testimony, and so that really opened up, you know, that's where I could really see what their labor practices were.
And what were they?
Well, I mean, there was age discrimination, there was basically, it was a kind of a brain drain, you know, where it was like up in the air. I don't know if you've I mean, they really had the cutter and gutter come in and just kind of get rid of everybody that was making big salaries and over the age of 55. It was called the gray day, which is, again, this is not unique to Bechtel. It's happening in newspapers in every state right now, too.
Right, right. So we've got a few minutes left. Let's come to the present day. President Obama is elected in 2008 and has very much of an ideology of a world without nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. Strangely, some former Bechtel people like George Shultz, who were as pro-nuclear as it's possible to be, start getting on the anti-nuclear bandwagon. Mm-hmm. What, explain this to us.
Well, that's, I think, a nice way to end this. It was the ultimate irony, I think, that George Shultz and Henry Kissinger, two men who have been intimately involved with Bechtel for many, many years, and especially in the nuclear proliferation throughout the world, are now leading, you know, the non-proliferation movement. They're called the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. And in order to, now they're trying to, you know, keep nuclear weapons from getting into the hands of terrorists. But this is after Bechtel and foreign policy has been creating nuclear reactors throughout the world for all these years. The sad irony of that, I think, is really President Obama, who came into office and gave a speech in the famous Prague speech in Czechoslovakia, where he said that what he wanted more than anything was a nuclear-free world. And somehow between that desire and he aligned himself actually with the Four Horsemen, which also include William Perry and Sam Nunn, he aligned himself with them, and what happened, the end result, has been not a lack of nuclear weapons, but a modernization program at the labs to kind of freshen up the bombs and modernize to such an extent that there's never been more money spent since even the height of the Cold War on refurbishing nuclear weapons. And I don't, you know, the way, however that happened, however Obama got hamstrung in that is, you know, I think a really sad story.
Yeah, that's another thing that's just so weird to people who are not involved in that world, is modernizing things that will never be used.
Mm-hmm.
The whole story of Bechtel, from the Hoover Dam and the breaking or taming of the Colorado River, and that metaphor of taming or breaking nature, which a century ago in a lot of ways made sense, where you had a great need for electricity and roads and infrastructure and things that all of us take for granted as not only necessities but good things. But the downside of that was unknown at the time, and now we know it well. The downside of industrialization being the destruction of ecosystems and pollution and climate change and tremendous disparity of wealth and horrible labor practices and all of the things that go along with industrialization. And one wonders whether a company like Bechtel, and it's one of many, is capable of catching up to the new reality, which is that those things are breaking our world.
Right. Well, I suspect that, I mean, I think it'll be really interesting to see this next generation, as I said, because they've made some, Brendan Bechtel, their has written an op-ed in USA Today about the importance of infrastructure. And I suspect that the next iteration of Bechtel for the 21st century now moving forward under the helm of Brendan Bechtel is going to be in I think we're going to see huge American contracts for rebuilding infrastructure that's going to go to Bechtel and probably throughout the world as well. And maybe the new generation of the Bechtel family will have a sensibility that is more environmentally conscious than the previous generations. I mean, I'm certainly probably a lot more forward-thinking than my great-grandparents.
Right. Anything that you want to leave with us? What were your own biggest takeaways from writing this book?
I think the biggest takeaway was the human toll. You know, it's one thing to write, this isn't a gotcha book. This isn't like, I mean, you've seen it. It's got 100 pages of end notes. It's not like I wasn't out to attack Bechtel. I didn't get like one, you know, fact that's going to, you know, say this is an evil company or something. It's kind of the combination. It's a book about history. All of this has been published before. I mean, I do have a lot of recently declassified documents that have not been published before, but I'm just pulling together historical documents that have been there. But I think the human toll of the workers at Hoover Dam, the human toll of the workers on the tap line in the Middle East, again, you know, brutal desert conditions. And I think more than a couple of things, Win Ho Lee, I thought the grotesqueness of him spending 278 or 9 days in jail in solitary confinement. This is a Chinese-American physicist under trumped-up charges that turned out to be false and, you know, shackled in a jail in New Mexico. That, and then even, you know, trying to find the heroes in this. I mean, Gary Gwilym, this lawyer in Oakland who is up against the biggest, one of the richest companies in America and doing this case against them, he's sitting up against, you know, six $500 an hour attorneys for every motion that was made, and to prevail. Someone like Greg Mello, who's essentially a Buddhist and engineer by training, who has devoted his whole life to trying to make the world a peaceful place and gets marginalized and ridiculed, and, you know, just like the people in this story.
Have you had any feedback from Bechtel after publishing this book?
Yes. Well, they responded to the Santa Fe New Mexican who did an interview with me last week. Their response is basically that I made available to them a review copy at the time the copies were made available to reviewers, and they made clear that they don't like the book, and I didn't expect them to.
Sally Denton is a historian, an investigative journalist, and author. Her new book is The Profiteers, Bechtel and the Men Who Built the World. Thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.